Hi everyone, Davinia here, and this season of Let's Make It Rain, the podcast, is sponsored by PensionBee, an online pension provider who's on a mission to make pensions simple so that customers all over the UK can become pension confident and save for a happy retirement. PensionBee's website and app make it simple for customers to combine their old pension pots, contribute flexibly, and withdraw their pension money all in one place. PensionBee offers a range of pension plans for a range of different needs, whether you're self-employed or want to invest responsibly with a fossil fuel-free or impact investing plan. Head to pensionbee.com or download the app to get started and become pension confident. Remember, as with all investing, your capital is at risk. And speaking of investing, for lots of us, we didn't start learning about how to save, spend, and invest our money for the future until we were well into our adulthood. I wrote Cash is Queen to change that. Cash is Queen is the world's first financial literacy book written exclusively for preteen and teenage girls, equipping them with everything they need to build solid financial foundations long before they start their first jobs. Buy it for your daughters, your nieces, your granddaughters, your goddaughters, and even yourselves. Link in show notes to find out more. Enjoy the episode. Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers. Those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today I'm excited to be joined by Danielle Bridge. Danielle is the founder of ABC Life Support CIC and interim CEO of Black Minds Matter UK, a charity matching black individuals to black therapists. Danielle, thank you so much for being here today. We've got so much to talk about. Can you introduce yourself for the benefit of the listeners?
Hi, thank you so much for having me, Davinia. It's so exciting to be here. I think you've introduced me. There's not really much else to say other than the fact that, yes, I'm running two organisations.
Yeah.
I am a mum, a wife, a friend, a confidant to an awful lot of people, facilitator, speaker. Yeah, all sorts of stuff. Quite a busy woman.
Yeah, and look at that. Look at how much else you were able to add to my one sentence introduction. So we're going to hopefully dive into some of those other things over the course of this conversation. But to begin with, I'd like to talk about Black Minds Matter, because of course, it's got a very specific mission and purpose, and it addresses one of the, I guess, prevailing myths or misconceptions about who therapy is for, which I think for listeners, just to give context to that, and certainly for my own, you know, if I think about my own cultural bias as someone that's Caribbean, therapy or the idea of getting access to counselling was never really viewed as something for us as black people, at least not in the black community. There is a huge taboo around it. We've been raised, the vast majority of us, on this idea of not airing out your dirty laundry in public or carrying your business onto the street. So, you know, yes. It's wonderful to see organizations like Black Minds Matter recognizing the fact that we all have mental health and we all need to make sure that we are doing something to manage our mental health and well-being. So why, in your view, is access to culturally sensitive therapy so important? Because we know that therapy exists, there's a whole industry around it, but why is that cultural sensitivity piece so important here?
Yeah, so you brought up some of the barriers that we have as a community as to why we find it difficult to access therapy. But you're right, everybody would benefit from therapy. And in terms of why we need culturally appropriate therapy is because of those things that you talked about, plus a plethora of others. So, for example, having an understanding of our culture, having an understanding of the lives that we lead as black people is part and parcel of the causes, I guess, sometimes of why people need therapy in the first place. So what you have is a situation where somebody recognises that they need therapy or they benefit from therapy. They go to reach out and access a therapist, let's say, for example, through normal routes like the NHS. They get to the end of a waiting list, which can be often very, very long. And then they see a therapist who has no idea of their cultural challenges, background, behaviours, you know, all of these things. And they spend half of their time trying to explain the reasons as to why they might need therapy to be met with a lack of understanding, which then puts another barrier, brings in shame and stigma and all of these things when you're there to try and seek help. So when you are matched with a therapist who is Black, they already understand some of the challenges that you have been through, which would mean that you would be there in the first place, right? So that's why it's important to have culturally appropriate and sensitive therapists, because half of the trauma, I guess, has already been recognized, and you don't need to dig deep about that to get to the root of why you're there as the individual in the first place.
Yeah, it's so true, because if I reflect back on two very distinct points in my life at which I have sought out therapy myself. So one was during my divorce and thinking, oh, actually, you know, this is a massive, whilst, you know, being classic Dav, type A, I've got this, it's fine, this is the best outcome all around. The other part of me was like, you know something, Dav, this is a major life event. You've got two small children that are dependent on you for their emotional well-being and everything else. I actually think you need to seek out some kind of support. And so I went to see someone. I think a friend of mine recommended that I get some therapy. And I saw someone, lovely woman, really well qualified, clearly well educated, obviously could take me through a number of the different techniques. But some of the examples that I gave her, you could literally see the horror on her face. Yeah. Things that perhaps, and this is not to say that we should in any way attempt to normalize some of those things. You know, there are certain things that happen in certain communities and cultures that actually absolutely should be called out. And sometimes it's that, you know, somebody else from another culture or ethnicity holding up a mirror to that, that the penny almost drops that actually this is not normal.
This is not right.
Yeah. It's not acceptable. But I do also remember that feeling, that creeping feeling and sense of dread whenever I would have those sessions, because I would think, I'm going to introduce a new concept to you that's not new for us culturally. But to you, you're going to have to get beyond, wait, that actually happens? Talk to me about that. Break it down in more detail. When actually, exactly as you've described, Danielle, if you're speaking to someone that maybe shares your culture, background or ethnicity, then there's that common understanding that just helps to make for a more seamless transition, particularly for those people like me who were already a bit skeptical about therapy before I started. Yeah.
Absolutely. And also what you've brought up there is quite interesting, because the therapist who has no idea of that background would inadvertently and sometimes unconsciously do their own learning through your trauma. Oh, I didn't know that was a thing, right?
You're right.
Like, talk to me more about that. You know, not wanting you to relive your trauma, but also wanting them to understand and find out a little bit more about the things that we go through. So it is really interesting, the point you bring up, because it's often what comes up in our industry. I've had therapy myself. I went through a really difficult time in COVID through a number of reasons. There was a racist incident about a letter posted through my door. I had to go to the court. Obviously, the murder of George Floyd. The lockdown was not very good to me at all. I'm an extrovert. I have to be out and about meeting people. So being in lockdown was traumatic for me as it was. And I sought help from a therapist on a waiting list with the NHS. And he was awesome. White guy, absolutely banging. And he was brilliant because of the kind of therapy that I needed. So also understanding about the modalities around therapy is also super important, because what I benefited from in that case was cognitive behavioral therapy. That is a reframing and a realignment of the way in which your brain works. That is not me going through trauma of my childhood or anything like that, where I would have to delve into things and subjects that might include my race, all right? So it's really important that people are aware of what kind of therapy is available, what we classify as modalities, and therefore what kind of support that they need in the first place. And this is where then culturally appropriate therapy is as beneficial.
Yeah, no, I love that, because actually, as you were speaking, I mean, the therapist that I've used more recently, again, following another life transition, you know, a major move overseas and thinking about how I integrate myself and my daughters into this new culture, one that we are familiar with, but still it's an alien culture, because we are, you realize when you are in a different environment, particularly one in which you actually associate and identify yourself most with. So I always refer to myself as Caribbean, but actually I'm a Brummie. I'm a Brummie that lived close to 20 years in London. So moving to the Caribbean, you know, it's not that seamless integration that you think it might be. And so speaking to someone to help me through that transition who shares my background and can therefore understand that context has been really powerful. But then when I reflect on the second time I sought out therapy, which was for a bereavement when my dad passed away, and it was a Jewish woman, and she was brilliant. And so you're quite right that we have to lean into what is it, you know, as you describe modalities, of course, you know, for in everyday parlance, we wouldn't necessarily be referring it to it as that, but it's kind of leaning into what is my actual need here?
Yes.
And, you know, who would be the best fit? But I think having access to a service like Black Minds Matter that can help you to navigate around what are some of the things that I'm thinking and feeling, and would somebody that is able to meet me culturally where I'm at, is that the best solution? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And the thing is, especially with the way in which BMM UK was founded, which was after the murder of George Floyd, in direct response to the trauma that we were carrying as a community.
Right.
And therefore, we do have a very clear connection to, you know, our cultural needs being met. So from that point of view, when people are thinking about therapy, it is up to the therapist and our matching service to be able to understand that person's need and match them to a therapist who is best qualified to be able to help and support them. I think from my point of view, it's important that we do have conversations like this in our communities to empower and to educate our people about these things, right? So, you know, we talk about the types of therapy that somebody could have access to, the longevity of that therapy, how long is it going to last for, et cetera, et cetera. Because if we can educate ourselves, then we can be really clear in our need when we go and approach help and support. And I'm a massive advocate for people understanding themselves to find out what sorts of support that they need. I think it's just my personality type, but I go to my doctors for certain issues and I tell my doctor what I need. There is no going in there and asking, you know, what I need, what I support is that I need to have. It is, this is what's happening. This is the signs and symptoms. This is how long it is. Based upon, you know, what I know about my body or what this is the kind of referral that I want. It's about educating and empowering our people to be able to access the services that they know that they need based upon their own lived experience.
Yeah, I'm interested in what you say about that, Danielle, because I think to myself, how can you know what you need? So for those of us that, you know, if you consider that there are lots of people walking around in probably a heightened state of, I don't want to say trauma because I think trauma can be overused and I don't think that I'm qualified to know whether someone's, you know, traumatized or not. But I think lots of us, you know, who are seemingly high functioning, but walking around in a heightened state of anxiety, stress, depression, lots of these things. And, you know, of course, given the work that I do around financial well-being, specifically for women, I know perhaps more than most the relationship between your financial well-being and your mental health. But how can people, and so there are some specific things that you can point to, you know, if you're in financial distress, you can say, actually, I'm kept awake at night because I've got this looming debt problem. Lots of people now who are about to be thrust into massively escalated rates of interest on their mortgage, for example, this might be a new trigger. And so you're able to pinpoint a very specific, tangible, I don't know, contributory factor to how your body feels. But if you're somebody that's walking around, you know, arguably in a state of, I want to say PTSD. You know, there are lots of people that have undiagnosed PTSD from what I read, post-traumatic stress disorder, and wouldn't necessarily have the vocabulary for that. How can they know that this is what they need based on your description?
Yeah, really good question. And actually, in terms of symptoms, signs, diagnosis, etc., diagnosis, which is what you've just described, a particular diagnosis of a condition, we can't diagnose them. You know, that has to be diagnosed by a medical professional, right? Somebody that works in that field. But what we tend to do, and I think it speaks to the way in which the world is with access to an awful lot of information, is that we have all of these things flinged around, you know, oh, they've got that, they must have this, they must have that. Unless you have a diagnosis, you have a profession which says that you are qualified to diagnose people with this, then we should kind of leave the diagnosis alone and actually go based upon person's behavior, changes, symptoms, signs, how are they behaving? What's the change in their personality like? And actually the work that I do with ABC Life Support, which is my organization, is training, and that's training around people accessing understanding awareness about how to support people on the ground. So two very different things with the organizations that I look after. But with ABC, we do mental health first aid training. That is privy to understanding how to recognize a change in somebody's personality, somebody's behavior, which therefore would prompt you as a helper to approach this person And to say to them, you know, I think something's going on. What's going on in your life? You know, is there any support that you can offer? And have these difficult conversations. So sometimes it's not about a person understanding what's going on with them. It's about them behaving in a way that gets picked up by others. And then the others having the confidence to be able to have conversations, which then open up a dialogue where a person might then start to see a change in themselves, have more conversations, and then access support if necessary.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so effectively it requires you to almost have the support of the village or the people that are around you, you know, the support of the community. And I think, you know, for in certain cultures, that's something that, you know, if you were raised on a diet or a habit of just having lots of people around you, perhaps you come from a large family, perhaps you come from a community in which there is a religious focal point and people gravitate or congregate there. And then you almost have an inbuilt community of people. That said, there are equally those people that, you know, maybe feel that they are, I don't want to say isolated from the group or feel that they are outliers. Perhaps you've moved away. Perhaps you are somebody that just feels that you don't fit in for whatever reason. And I know that you say, and I agree with you, that, you know, it's a difficult thing to kind of self-diagnose. None of, I mean, particularly if you don't have that clinical ability, those professional qualifications, you cannot self-diagnose. But even in just thinking about, you know, as our own first line of defense, and we'll talk about in a minute, the difference between mental first aid and therapy. But as a first line of defense, how could I identify triggers in myself? Could I be journaling something? Is it, you know, noticing changes in my diet, behavior, spending habits? Are there any, are there any examples of clues?
Yeah, all of those, everything you've just mentioned, actually. Okay. And I think that that whole idea of knowing yourself, you know, being self-aware in terms of how you might be behaving. So I'll give you an example. Throughout lockdown, I started to change because I was finding it really difficult getting out of bed and having that joyous, oh, you know, today's Wednesday and I'm going to go to work. It was the same thing day after day after day. And then what started to happen for me personally was that, and a lot of other people actually within our culture specifically, is that I started to ruminate about things that happened in my childhood. And I had a quite difficult childhood. But I was very busy. And again, you probably, people will often go, oh, okay, well, why are you busy? You know, you're trying to kind of get rid of these things or not think about them. And there might be something in that. But I found myself in a position of finding that there was so much space in my head that things that I'd forgotten about or things that I found quite traumatizing from being a child and living in the situation that I found myself in as a child were coming back to haunt me. And I started to think about them, and that caused me to feel certain things like sadness or anxiety, or and they what we call ruminated. So that means you think about them constantly all of the time. Then I was distracted from the other things that were going on in my life. I was quite ratty. And I picked these things up thinking, this isn't me. What, you know, what's going on? And actually, these thoughts that I'm having aren't very comfortable and I can't get rid of them. No matter how many times I might meditate or journal, they are playing on my mind. And therefore, for me, that is a clear reason to go and seek help and support, which is what I did. But that's because I have a really heightened self-awareness. And not a lot of people have that. What might happen in that case for somebody else is that they would do everything it is that I've just explained, but they wouldn't know that they need support and help. That might then affect their relationships. So the relationships in their lives might start breaking down and somebody's saying, you know, what's going on? No, nothing, because they don't want to talk about it because of, you know, cultural needs or cultural barriers, etc. So it's about understanding who you are. And if you have self-awareness, picking up on that and making a decision to do something about it, or hoping, like you said earlier on, that the village picks up on that and starts to have that conversation to be able to seek help and support.
Definitely. And actually the village, your village might be one person, you know.
That's right.
It's just about having somebody that is around you that can identify. And it's, of course, it's far easier for someone on the outside looking in to observe those changes in behaviour. In my case, for example, I've got two daughters that make me laugh, but I remember, you know, you've talked a lot about lockdown, and I remember there were certain instances during lockdown. I mean, I was able to keep myself busy. I baked a lot. I did a lot of exercise. It was, you know, for the most part, I tried to make the best of a horrific situation. But my anxiety was certainly heightened in the run-up to those ridiculous press conferences that Boris would do on a daily basis. And, you know, my family and I would be in the group chat going, oh, God, like, what's he going to say today? And it was to the point where I had to tune out the family chat and those daily bulletins, you know, or my sister interpreting what she thinks Boris is going to say. And I had to tune those things out. But I remember one instance where my then six-year-old said to me, Mommy, why are you frowning? She said, why are you growling? And I was like, what is growling? That's not even a word. She's like, I think, but she meant frowning. She's like, Mommy, why are you frowning your face? And I was like, really, am I? She's like, yeah. And of course, you need someone to hold that mirror up to you without the physical mirror.
Yeah.
I have general resting bleep face. So people that know me will be like, oh, yeah, no, Dav's really not like her face appears. But yeah, sometimes you just need that person that can say, no, you look like this. Do you feel like that?
Yes.
Or what's going on for you?
Yeah, yeah, love that.
So yeah. So thinking about then the difference between mental first aid and therapy, and I love the idea of mental first aid because it's that idea of the first line of defense. Mm. How does it differ from therapy?
Yeah, good question. So therapy is something that should be delivered over a period of time. It's a one-on-one, or sometimes families or couples, whatever. And it's about you entering into a dialogue with somebody who can help you to unpack the things that you've packed that lead you to a position where you need to unpack it. Mm-hmm. So they are, and again, sometimes, you know, I've heard people say to me, oh, I did counseling, it sucked, you know, it was really bad. And I was like, well, why? What kind of counseling did you have? And she said, the counselor just sat there while I was crying and just handed me a tissue. And I was okay. Yeah, I know what you mean. So there are, let's also be really clear, there are an awful lot of therapeutic interventions. The therapy that we deliver as a charity is talking therapy. So that's where you go talk. And the whole point is that you talk and unpack some of the things that it is that you need to unpack. But the therapist might be a counsellor or a therapist who sits and just listens. You'd be talking and, you know, telling him or her or them everything, and they're just nodding. Okay. Mm. And then they're passing you a tissue and you're like, well, why is this person not helping, you know? But they are, because they're giving you a space for you to offload all of this
stuff.
Whereas some people would see a therapist and the therapist would ask questions. So tell me how that feels. And actually, let's stop you there. Let's start to push down this avenue now. So they are more directive in their approach. You will then get a therapist who might use body work. So therefore, they're connecting your feelings and thoughts to what how you feel in your body. So it's an awful lot more kind of intuitive around your own body and your own mind and what's going on for you. So as you can see, there's three different types of therapists, right? For the same thing, it's talking therapy. But then other people would say that, you know, having friends as therapists, I've got a really, really wonderful network of people in my life who are probably therapists because they provide me with a space to be able to talk about these things that I don't necessarily need to speak to a trained therapist for. So that's what therapists do. And like I said, it's normally over a period of time. We offer therapy for 12 weeks. Some organizations offer therapy for 2 years. Some people have therapy for years and years and years and years. If somebody has a really complex diagnosis, something, for example, like a personality disorder, for example, dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT, lasts for years if that person can access that service. So there are different types of therapy that a person can access. Mental health first aid is very different because it teaches an individual the basics around mental health and diagnosis. We don't deep dive into that because it's unnecessary. But what we do is to talk to people about how to understand that there is a change in somebody, you know, that somebody's going through something, how to recognize signs and symptoms of poor mental health, how to have a conversation and how to approach somebody effectively, and then also how to signpost. And that's really important. Mental health first aiders are people on the ground who are taught this skill to be able to help. They become the village.
Right.
But they're not the doctor in the village.
Okay, yeah.
All right, so they're the people that can recognise help and support, but they are not the person that provides that professional intervention because they're not qualified to do so. Mm. And it's really important that people do understand their barriers.
Absolutely.
And, you know, their limitations in terms of what they can and cannot do. And I said to somebody months ago about a mental health first aider being equivalent to like a physical first aider. If you walk in down the road and you collapse, a physical first aider would be able to come along, check to see if you're breathing, put you in the recovery position, or carry out CPR if necessary.
Mm-hmm.
What they can't do is to pop your chest, internal massage and do all kind of other stuff, right? They're not the, they are not that person, but they are the person that can keep that person alive or viable until professional help arrives. The same thing is with a mental health first aider. They are not the person to do the work. They are the person to recognize that that person would benefit from help and support and to then signpost them to the person best qualified to do that.
Brilliant. Brilliant description. Thank you so much. Because I think for lots of us, particularly when we see, you know, lots of, you know, therapy as an industry, at least in the UK, is quite a nascent thing. I mean, of course, it's existed. It will have existed. And there'll be certainly people that have been able to get access to it. But I think in terms of self-directed or self-led therapy, in terms of people recognizing, oh, actually, I could do with some support, I think that's relatively new. And so the idea that there might be something, there might be an intervention before you get into a kind of one-on-one relationship with the therapist, for example, or with your partner, as you said, I think it's really, really useful and quite a powerful way for you to get that initial triage, get that, you know, bit of mental triage before you commit to something longer term. And actually, that brings me on to my next question about, you know, thinking about the normalization of therapy in the UK. And of course, you know, we talk about, you know, with regard to Black Minds Matter, how therapy and getting access to support around your mental wellness can become more normalized among within the Black community specifically. But then just more broadly, thinking on a societal level, it's becoming more normalized in the UK as a whole, where previously we would have viewed it as something that was more common in the US. And for lots of us, our introduction or exposure to that will have been through US sitcoms, where people might have been talking about therapy.
Yeah.
And you're fascinated by it because you're thinking, wow. And actually, being completely candid, I know I don't speak for everybody in the UK, but for lots of us, there certainly is this prevailing preconception about the difference between Americans and Brits. And this idea that, you know, for Americans, at least in the past in seeking out therapy, it was something that was self-indulgent or something that was for the privileged few or whatever. What do you think has accounted for this shift in attitudes and mindset across these continents?
TV, definitely, I think, you know, that has to be. It's the cultural directives, isn't it?
Yes.
Our phones. Social media is a lot of things. I've got a love-hate relationship with social media, but it has done its part in the way in which it opens us up to popular activities, if you like. So by listening to people's experiences, by understanding, by listening to podcasts or interviews that you might see, people talking about therapy, it definitely has helped to bridge the gap, I guess, between us as Brits accessing this service and the US. But also what I'd like to point here, therapy has always, like you said, always been available here, but it's always been in social services. You know, it's for people who are in services who need help and support, they get therapy. Now it's about everybody understanding the benefits of therapy and the accessibility to therapy. It is an expensive endeavor, £65 an hour. That's outside of the realms of an awful lot of people living in the UK, especially now, cost of living crisis, et cetera, et cetera. It's a lot of money. And it's about whether or not you need it. Then you have to then play into that narrative of, oh, well, it's fine, I'll sort myself out. So therefore, it doesn't become something that is a priority. You know, it almost becomes something that people go, yeah, but, you know, I don't really need it. I'm not really unwell. Or therefore, I will put that aside. It's not something that I desperately need. So if you're kind of signposted therapy via the normal mediums in the UK, which is a waiting list, NHS, etc., you get it at the end and it's free. But then you've also got the barrier of the waiting list, you know, being a long time and nobody's helping, nobody's providing some support. So it has always been there. It has always been available in social services. But now I think it's being discussed from an individual point of view, an affordability point of view, and whether or not we should just be able to access it anyway. So it's still a service that people believe is quite elitist, I guess, which is why BMM UK is trying to break down those barriers by offering hours for free. Because once we start to allow people to understand the benefits of it and to taste it, to test it and to see, you know, how it can be beneficial, that person we're hoping is then going to go and spread the word to their community, to their family, to their friends, so that other people can then access the service as it stands.
Yeah, that makes total sense. But then I suppose just following on from that then, Danielle, you know, we've talked about some of the triggers for us in recognizing that we need to seek out some additional support, or, you know, if you were part of the village, what sorts of patterns or clues you should be looking for in someone else's behavior. But in your view, does everyone need therapy? Or is it something that we should view as circumstantial?
Wow, do you know what? It's a really interesting question. Because I think everybody would benefit from a therapeutic type intervention throughout their life.
Mm-hmm.
And how that comes across would depend upon the severity of the person's case, right? So I have, for example, when I introduced myself as a confidant. A lot of people talk to me about an awful lot of things. They always have done, even when I was a teenager. Because I don't know, I happen to have that kind of brain, I think, you know, or the empathy that I carry. So I'm always thinking about people and their feelings and their thoughts and how they can feel better and, you know, be well. That would be a therapeutic intervention for somebody. And it might mean that that person doesn't ever need to have therapy because they have somebody that is like me in their life that is able to provide that bit for them. So that is a type of therapy. It's not professional therapy at all, but the outcomes of feeling listened and understood are probably met at that time. Whereas somebody who has an awful lot of things to unpack that are dangerous or shameful or all of these things, who do not feel safe to be able to talk to their friend about it, would potentially need somebody professional who is bound by confidentiality to not talk your business to other people. You know, they might need that intervention. So to answer your question, yes, I think everybody would benefit from therapy, depending upon the type of therapy that they need. I think everybody they should seek out being listened to, I guess.
Yeah, no, brilliant response. And then thinking about then some of the myths around therapy that you'd like to tackle. I mean, we've covered, Black Minds Matter exists to tackle one of them, which is that, you know, therapy is just for people from certain ethnicities and not others. Are there any other prevailing myths that you think, you know, actually these need to just go in the bin?
Yeah, do you know what? You touched on one earlier, especially within our community. We've got to stop talking people's business. You know, this myth that actually you're going out there and talking people's business. No, I'm not talking people's business. I'm talking my business, which might include somebody else. Do you know what I mean? By default. But that's my stuff. And, you know, there is this whole thing about if something's happened to somebody or somebody's going through something, you should have to think about everybody involved. Well, actually, no. From a personal point of view, if it affects me as an individual, then I need to deal with that in the way in which it affects me. You know, I might not have to mention your name, but I do need to talk about what's happened because it has affected me, you know. So that is number one. And that comes directly from our community in terms of breaking down those barriers, which is what we are trying to do in talking about this and bringing it to the forefront of people's awareness. The other one I want to talk about, which is super important, is that this concept or this idea that when you have therapy, it's going to fix you. Oh, you just need some therapy. You know, you sort yourself out.
Or that you're in some way broken. You know, implicit in that is that you're broken if you need help.
Absolutely, that you're broken, right? And you need help. And the way in which people utilize that language, again, is super important because I would say to people, I was broken. And what that might mean for me is not broken in the way that people perceive me or see me, but broken in the way in which I cannot function, in the way in which I'm used to and the which I want to. And that's a self-led language for me. So when we talk about people being broken, it's not like as in broken, oh, poor you, you're not broken, you're fine. No, it's not that. It's actually, I can't function in the way in which I want to. And therefore, I might perceive the terminology being broken as myself. So therapy will fix you. And this is a really big deal, something I've seen in my years of working. When people are struggling or have challenges, they automatically enter the service or the system and they want to have help and support. And I hear it an awful lot. You know, social services are crap. They don't work. My mum's a mental health social worker, an adult mental health social worker. And I'm telling people, I see her every day. And I want you to tell her to her face that she's not helping you, right? After 25 years of working in that service, the system is broken. And when you enter into it, we have to take some responsibility about what we want, what our expectations of therapy are, and how much work and effort it's going to take for you to get onto your personal road of recovery. That might mean that therapy is the beginning, but you also have to do some of the work. And that might be the way in which you see the world. It might be the way in which you interact with people. It's doing an awful lot of work around your own awareness of self and the way in which you interact with the world. So there is an awful lot of work. It is not a matter of going to therapy, speaking to somebody for 12 weeks and your life being fixed, because, you know, that's not going to happen. Mm-mm. You know, life doesn't work like that. There are ups and downs, ins and outs, peaks and troughs throughout the rest of our life. And acceptance of that, I think, is also quite key.
Yeah, no, I mean, the point about not talking our business outside, it's a really big one. And I think it's just this idea, this fear that perhaps comes from experience, you know, lots of the misconceptions that we have are often rooted in an experience at one time or another that then becomes conflated over, you know, years and years, and it becomes like Chinese whispers. And then in the end, it just doesn't bear any resemblance to what the original fear might have been. But I think it's this idea of a kind of lack of confidentiality, or the idea that, you know, in speaking to this person, they're then going to run around and tell everybody about your business, even if it's somebody completely independent and impartial. And actually, that can extend into, you know, if I'm a Black person and I'm seeing a Black therapist and it's somebody from the Caribbean and it's somebody from my specific island, that really narrows it down.
Yes.
And actually that really amplifies the fear in our minds, because we're like, gosh, if you come from a certain island,
what if you go to my business?
Right? They're going to know somebody that knows my mom or knows my gran, or I'm going to see them at a wedding, or I'm going to see them at a funeral. That's a problem. And then that just heightens this feeling of, you know, we can't discuss anything. We have to be fortresses and,
you know,
carry all of that, you know,
well, so that's
all
that pain inside. Choice, right? You have choice.
Precisely.
Because, for example, with our therapy matching, if you are matched with a therapist and after one or two sessions, there is a reason why your therapy is unlikely to be successful, then you can always come back, and obviously it's a case by case, and we will match you to somebody else. So it is a matter of you being comfortable, because let's face it, if there is a barrier between you and your therapist where it's going to stop you from talking and doing the unpacking and doing the work that you need to do, then what's the point? You know, there's just no point. So we want people to be happy and to also to allow themselves the autonomy to be able to step up and say, actually, do you know what? I'm not comfortable with this therapist because they come from the same village as me in the island that I come from. It's going to be unhelpful because I can't speak to them. I just can't let go.
Exactly.
Okay, that's a very valid reason for us to look for somebody else for you.
Yeah.
You know, background, language barriers, you know, cultural backgrounds, faith being another thing, you know. So all of these things, it's super important to take into consideration when laying down the foundations and the groundwork to be able to enter into therapy.
Absolutely. And actually, I'm really pleased that you've highlighted that, because I think this idea that when you sign up to therapy and you're, you know, and in this, the case of Black Minds Matter UK, being assigned a therapist or matched to a therapist, then feeling like, oh gosh, is it ungrateful to say I don't want this person? Like, is it awkward? So yeah, reminding people that they are ultimately in control of that relationship and they have advocacy over their, you know, that relationship and what might be the best outcome for them, I think is really important. Let's talk about social media, because you mentioned your love-hate relationship with social media. And my friends and I, and my sister and I talk about this at length, the way people, and of course I feel it personally as somebody that's talking about personal finance, that there are arguably unqualified people. And of course, experience and qualification don't necessarily have to be, at least in, you know, in finance, that it doesn't always have to be, you know, you've been down this formal traditional route, as I have. It could be your lived experience. If you're talking about, you know, overcoming debt, if you're talking about, you know, this is how I've saved money, even if you're talking about this is how I have personally built my investment portfolio, there is a lot of scope for people to share their relatable testimonies and experiences, because it can empower someone else. The challenge, of course, comes when they're speaking about something that drifts into a, particularly in the case of finance, a particularly technical area, something that exposes unsuspecting people to an element of risk that they haven't appropriately articulated, and people just don't know what they're signing up for. There is a similar challenge when it comes to psychology, because everybody's a budding psychologist or everybody's an expert.
Yes.
And the language and the vocabulary that like seemingly abounds on social media, you know, this I refer to it as kind of pop psychology. But effectively, you know, there's been a lot of advances. Social media has been a great unifying and globalizing force in giving people access to things that maybe previously you wouldn't have been aware of. But the problem, of course, with that benefit comes the real drawbacks around these things becoming part and parcel of our daily vocabulary. So people are regularly referred to as narcissists
or
gaslighters. And if it's not that, then it's, you know, you are being exhorted to live your best life, live a soft life, quietly quit. And you're just thinking, oh my God, how are all these people quietly quitting, living a soft life? Isn't anyone paying bills? Is anybody working? And it's just awful. And then I have people say to me, you should be living a soft life because you're talking to women about finance. So you should be demonstrating what it means to amass a huge amount of wealth and to be living on a sailing on a yacht somewhere. I mean, not obviously forgetting or ignoring the fact that I am terrible on a boat or on water, full stop. So that wouldn't be my soft life. But, you know, there's all of these different things and tropes that are flung out there. And if you consider that women are the biggest users on Instagram, so thinking about Instagram specifically, we're the biggest demographic in terms of usage. What does that do for your mental well-being if you are nowhere near close to being able to live this so-called soft life? What does the soft life even mean? It might mean different things to different people, but the way it's depicted and presented is always in this idyllic kind of, it's always on an island,
of course,
you know sunbathing, and someone's bringing you fruits, and maybe you're in a beautiful villa. There's always this sense of luxury that's conferred, excusing the fact or ignoring the fact that, you know, for lots of us that may not be our idea of soft life. I've got friends that are like, I'd rather die than sit on the beach. Like, it's just not for me.
But
this idea, and then even, I mean, I've referred to it as toxic positivity here. The word toxic even is overused. So can you, as somebody that operates within this space, Danielle, what would you say? Because I know that we, even in the Rain Check social media, I have to be very careful in guarding against or screening some of the content that the team share or put together, if it in any way could potentially, and of course you can't guard against everything, but if it could in any way lead someone to be suddenly filled with this sense of, if not self-loathing, that's extreme, but a feeling that they are not where they should be, or that they are failing at life because they are not living their best life and they don't know how to protect their peace. And what does know your worth actually mean? Because if I go into my job and say, I want a pay increase, I'll be fired without remorse.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I don't know, what would you say? What advice would you have for those people that are on social media and, you know, find themselves drifting into this comparison, comparing their lives with other people on the internet, strangers, and as a result, feeling inadequate? It's a big question.
No, do you know what it is? I'm so glad you brought it up, though, because it is a fascinating question. And there is, obviously, with a big question, there probably isn't a straightforward answer. I think it's multifaceted. Again, I go back to what I said earlier in terms of knowing yourself. And that's part and parcel, that's halfway, that's half of the problem. Because even with all of the self-awareness that I have, I am guilty of going onto social media and living exactly what you've just thought about, you know. Oh, Danielle, you should have this and you should have that and you should be here and you should be there and you shouldn't be behind your desk and you should be blah, 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 blah. And a lot of shoulds, you know, or coulds. And the irony is, though, I'm telling myself based upon what I've seen. So this goes back to something which I harp on about all the time. And it's something called the frame of reference. A frame of reference is how you view the world. And what we've got in society as a problem, specifically around social media, is that everything on it comes from a sense of self. Everybody looks through their own lens, their own view of the world. And what they see, they then apply to that very same thing. So when I see somebody living their best life, you know, you should be doing this and the blah, 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 blah. In my head, I'm going, oh, well, I'm looking at it now and maybe I should. It's a frame of reference. It's that person's frame of reference. And also, let's be very clear. Half of that stuff is promotional lies. You know, it's promotion, it's PR, it's
big
all
lies.
That, it's hype. And I get it. It's a job. But people cannot differentiate between what goes on in their screen as they scroll, how much effort and work went into that to make it look not difficult. And then they apply themselves to what it is that they've got. In the mental health space on Instagram, it's really, really, really bad. I mean, some people are adding the word syndrome to an awful lot of things and it becomes a problem. And I'll give you an example. I was watching something the other day and a young woman came on and was talking about people pleaser syndrome in direct response to her children. And what was upsetting was what she was talking about was very interesting and actually quite true. So she was talking about when you have young children, making your children have autonomy over their decisions, especially with people. So for example, you know, when I was a kid, it was like, I'll go and kiss your auntie, blah, 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 or your uncle, blah, blah, blah. And I've never met them before, or I've never seen them. And I have to walk over and go and kiss them, pun them cheeks. Hi, you know, and it was that thing. It was a respect thing. It was a cultural thing.
Yes.
Whereas she was saying, actually, you should leave that to your children. They should be comfortable with going and doing these things. So I believe, I understand, seriously, I was like, yeah, this is wicked. Until she added the word syndrome at the end of it. Because if you then call it people pleaser syndrome, it becomes something that you're looking for a diagnosable set of signs and symptoms for. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. And that can be dangerous because then everybody can do that, right? Everybody can do that. And that for me is where it becomes a problem. And you talked about gaslighting.
We're all being gaslit everywhere, everybody's every day.
Being gaslit. And I'm like, do you actually know what gaslighting is? It is
I don't think anyone does.
traumatic, difficult behavior where you are made to test your, you know, to think about your own sanity, you know, over a period of time. That's not just because you upset somebody. That's not gaslighting. You know, I've had to explain this to a few people before. So yeah, it's social media, I think. And also what I think is a problem as well is that we know this. Everything you've talked about, we know it. So therefore, we're almost living something that we know is not true and still behaving as if it is. And therein lies the problem. That's a real problem for me.
Yeah, agreed. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I'm as guilty as anybody else
referring
to people as gaslighter or, oh, it's because he's a narcissist, you know.
You can have these very casual
conversations, but it was only, but you know, very recently, I would say in the last year, that my sister and I have been like, gosh, I'm exhausted of you. These labels and this language, are they actually accurate? Or is that individual just a liar? Or is that person, do you know what I mean? Have they just misled us in one way or another? But to call them a narcissist, that's an actual diagnosable category of behavior or disorder or whatever.
Yes, absolutely.
And so on that basis,
really difficult one.
Right. So I mean, I'm certainly nowhere near qualified as a psychologist. It's not something that I would ever be good at. So, you know, for us to fling those labels around, and it really then, you know, kind of led us into this conversation around how can people decipher or determine the difference between what is good quality information and what isn't? How can you know? Who should I be following? How can I guard and protect my mindset? Do you have any tips on that? You know, do you need to make sure that it's a clinical psychologist? And there's some brilliant ones that I follow, but you know, how would you know?
Great question. Also, why? Why are you following them? What the content? What's the content that you're trying to get together from that? Mm-hmm. If it's somebody who is non-qualified talking about behavior in society and using clinical words, drop them because they are not a clinician.
Right.
Drop them, you know, unfollow, because this is where you then have a problem. And the reason why I talk about why you're following them, if you are interested in psychology or you're interested in mental health or you're interested in these things, then it makes sense to follow somebody who is an expert in that field. If you're following popular culture and people are utilizing that language in their everyday language, then therein lies a bit of a red flag for me. And, you know, it's something you talked about. I have never, because of the work that I do, I've never flung those names out and about. I've never utilized, you know, oh, they're a narc, because I know what they are, right? So therefore, I'm never, ever going to use that word. But my son, who's 15, is quite fascinating, because the other day, and I think I did something on social media about it, because he said, "Mum, what's going on?" I was dropping him off somewhere, and he said, "Mum, what's going on? This weather's a bit bipolar, isn't it?"
Oh, God.
I went, "What did you just say?" He went, a bit bipolar. I was like, "Okay, son." First of all, and I got in the car, and he goes, he kind of rolls his eyes at me, because he's like, oh, gosh, here we go. Because I have educated my children from the time they were able to listen, watch, being exposed to popular culture. So I said, first of all, when he got in the car, I said, "Do you know what bipolar disorder is?" He said, "No." I said, "Do you really think it's got anything to do with the weather?" And he went, "No." I said, so I explained to him what bipolar disorder is. And he went, "Okay, cool. Yeah, got it." And that was it. It was as simple as that. Because prior to that, I remember him coming home to me one day and saying to me, "Mum, a psychopath, being psycho isn't good, is it?" I said, "No, it's a diagnosis." And he said, because somebody in my chat said that somebody was being a psycho. And I said that you mustn't say that, because we can't call people psychopaths if we don't know what it means. And I kind of was like, yes, go on, son. Yes,
I like
I've been
that.
Doing my teaching to my children and they're learning and they're listening. So, yeah, even from then, and he's 15. So, you know, we're talking about a couple of years ago. So these words that we use are being used prevalently in culture. It's up to us to stop using those labels, to stop name calling, actually, isn't it? Ultimately, it's name calling. We don't need to name call. We can talk about people's behaviours and how it affects us.
Exactly.
But we certainly don't need to name call.
We don't need to label them. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
So thinking about, for anybody listening who thinks, gosh, I'm utterly sold based on what Danielle has shared, but I can't afford therapy. So what can I do? You know, what mindset hacks do you have? Are there any, you know, for people that really recognize they've done that, they're self-aware, they recognize I could really do with some support. Mm. I'm struggling a bit. Don't really know where to begin. Are there any free or low-cost resources that you can point people towards that are credible?
Yes, there's loads. Yeah. So first of all, what I would say is if anybody's thinking about accessing therapy, start the process. So for example, you know, you hear people talking about the waiting list being really, really long. Yes, they are. So put your name down on it first and then worry and complain about how long it is, right? Because hopefully by the time you've started to seriously take it seriously, you might be at the beginning, you know, at the top of the list. Also, opting for students is also a really good thing. If, you know, you can say, oh, I'm ready for a student, because that way they don't charge as much. They've got more accessibility. They've got more time. And they always get their own therapists. So they always have supervision. So you're never on your own, even if it's like, you know, one person removed. So that's the first thing I would say. If you're thinking about therapy, try and access a waiting list now and then do some more work and research while you're on it, because that way the time will go quite quickly. The other thing is free resources online. So for example, there is something called Chasing the Stigma, which is the Hub of Hope, an amazing directory that's available online. And you could type in your postcode and it will bring you up, and you put in kind of what, you know, might be depression or bereavement or something like that. And then it'll give you a list of organizations closest to you that you can then access. So it takes a long time. That's the thing, I think. And that's why I said earlier on about understanding what kind of support might benefit you before you start looking. Because once you start looking, it's a massive, massive pool of potential, and you don't really know, you know, where to begin.
One of the things that someone shared with me before, and it certainly works for me, but then I'm somebody that loves writing things down. I'm always documenting my thoughts. And actually, I've now taken to, I'm writing things down all the time, everywhere. It used to be in notebooks. Now I've taken it as far as writing little notes in my phone. So, you know, if I'm feeling something or thinking something, I'll write it in my phone. Sometimes I just want to freeze frame that thought or feeling and then come back to it a few days later or in, you know, a few months or whatever, and come back and see if anything has shifted. Is that something that people might do as well? Journaling or just documenting their thoughts if they're not already doing that? Is that helpful?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, and also, again, it's interesting. When we talk about well-being and mental health, I just want to make it really clear. We all have mental health, right? Every single person has mental health. Not everybody lives with poor mental health, and certainly not everybody lives with mental illness. So it's really important for us to recognize those. So when we're talking about well-being, you know, journaling, meditation, yoga, all of those sorts of things which help to maintain good mental health, fantastic. But when somebody's in the grips of poor mental health, journaling, meditation isn't going to cut the mustard for that person. Okay. So it's about being clear in terms of the differentiator between people who are unwell mentally and people who wish to maintain a good and positive mental health. And I think that's what we see on Instagram is how to, you know,
caring,
the good
mental
health. Yeah, exactly. It's great, you know, talking to your friends and going out for walks and yoga and all of these things, which are absolutely amazing and accessible by most people. But you cannot access that if you are in the depths of a disorder or a diagnosis, which is really, really difficult and really challenging, because it comes across as patronizing.
Yes.
So for people who, you know, who, for example, for me, if meditation works sometimes, but if I'm living with heightened anxiety, it doesn't work at all because it starts to focus on...
meditation doesn't work for me at all.
It doesn't work, right? So it's about understanding yourself. So yeah, journaling, meditation, yoga, being still, digital detox, drop the phone, turn your mobile phone off for a while, going out, especially now, you know, in the UK, we have a very, very small window of lovely weather. So enjoy it, right?
Yes.
It's going to disappear. So enjoy the weather, speaking to your friends, doing things that you love, going back to all of the things that make your soul sing. If that's taking walks, meditating, riding your bike, singing, playing your piano, knitting, whatever it is, you know, do more of that. And that will help to maintain good mental health.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I love that. So now just changing tack slightly and thinking about your personal relationship with money, because we know the relationship and that correlation between money and mental health, good and bad. How would you describe your relationship with money, Danielle, and how has it evolved over time?
Oh, Davinia, do you know what? First of all, I've been waiting for this question. I have been waiting for this question because it is so fascinating. And I have been thinking an awful lot about this question since you invited me onto the show. And I've been doing some deep work, actually, around this question. So my relationship with money has been super complex. Super complex, and I have a very difficult relationship with money. And the reason why I have a difficult relationship with money is because I come from a childhood where we had nothing. I mean, absolutely nothing. We were on the breadline. We were under the care of social services. There was an awful lot of help and support needed in our family. And money was something I never had. It was something that my mother never had. It was something that my father never had. And so I always lived without, you know. And also when you then grow up in an atmosphere or in an area, community where, or in a household where you don't have anything, you learn to make do with what you have. And that meant that I learned to not ask my mum for things because I knew we didn't have the money. It caused an awful lot of shame, I guess, outside of my home when my friends were going out with their trainers and they're this, that and the other, and I didn't have it, or we were getting our clothes from car boot sales and stuff like that because my mum didn't have any money. So having nothing and coming from nothing and then growing up and being in a position to have abundance, and I live in abundance, financially, emotionally, you know, all of those things. It has been a really interesting journey for me. But some of the mindset that I had in the very beginning hasn't changed. So I don't have a very good relationship with it because I'm always like, well, if you've got it, it's nice, but it might not be there. So, you know, I don't really build much on it, or I don't really think about it too much. But my husband, and I was talking to him about this the other day, he comes from a completely different background where money is something that you have to have, you have to work for, and it is really important. So in our marriage now, we have a relationship where we are comfortable, we are very, very comfortable. But it's all driven by him, because I'm a bit like, okay. It's great. Yeah, we've got it. It's nice. And I can have holidays and I don't spend any money. I'm still quite, I've got a hole in my trainer, so maybe I should go and get a new pair. Do you know what I mean? That kind of thing. Because I think that's what happens when you come from nothing. So it's a very complicated relationship with money, actually.
Yeah. And that's really interesting. Thank you for sharing that so candidly, because I think it just serves to underline this research or data point that I talk about all the time. I mean, it's part of the reason why, you know, when I was writing Cash is Queen and thinking about, you know, why I'm so dedicated to improving financial literacy, not just for girls, but of course, you know, we know women and girls are disproportionately impacted by some of these financial inequalities. But we know that children form some of their earliest money habits in childhood from the age of about 7. And that those habits, if they go unchecked, carry forward and carry through into your adulthood and then impact and influence how you behave as an adult.
Yes.
You know, for better or worse, you know, exactly as you've described, you know, you and your husband, and imagine, you know, all of these different relationships and potential conversations happening all around the country and across the globe. Some people are more open to having money conversations, perhaps because they discussed it openly at home. Others weren't, because it was viewed as something that was disrespectful to be, you know, asking your parents or discussing money with your parents. Some had an abundance of money, others didn't. Even in terms of spending habits, what did you observe in your household around how spending decisions were being taken? Did you have one parent who was, you know, rushing in from having been out shopping and hiding the bags? You know, you hear these, you see those memes about mom hiding the shopping bags from dad, which, you know, can be, you know, and I'm sure there are lots of people who, despite the stereotype, the obvious stereotype there, but there are lots of people that can relate to some of those memes. So yeah, it's really interesting, I think. And as you said, you know, in thinking about what is my personal relationship with money, because I like to ask this question, it's not necessarily something that you would be thinking about on a day-to-day.
No.
You just get paid, you pay your bills, you have what's left, and then you just kind of, you know, roll with it.
But
I think there's a lot of power in, you know, opening up these conversations, for sure.
I think so. And, you know, and it's funny because it's like overthinking. I just do me. This is who I am. And I was thinking, you know, maybe Danielle, again, don't talk people's business. You can't talk people's business when you're... I think it's super important for people to understand and experience that everybody has a past. Everybody has a life that they have lived. And if my story can help one person understand how they feel, actually, that's the reason why I feel the way I do. It would make sense. And, you know, the other thing about growing up with a lack is that you do appreciate when you do have it, that actually I'm not materialistic at all, which actually sometimes I think is my downfall. Because when I then look at those people we were talking about earlier on Instagram, living their best lives, I'm like, really? I've got time for, really? When did you get time for that? Like, I need to go shopping. Like, that's a lot. I hate shopping. You know, all of these things. For me personally, like, I'll talk about my frame of reference. But what one thing it has kind of taught me to think about is my relationship with my children and money. This is fascinating. And I love your book. I'm going to buy it. I've mentioned it to my daughter. And I'm going to buy it because, and my son actually, because there is a serious issue, I think, in the way in which we bring up our children and the way in which we talk about money with our kids. And I was listening to your episode with one of your guests, and it was talking about how we shouldn't put the onus of our experience on our own children. And I had to pause it. I was like, girl.
Yeah.
Because I have been guilty of doing that. I've been guilty of, my goodness, I come from nothing. Therefore, you should be, you need to appreciate where you've come, you know, that you've got what you've got. And I remember my son turning around to me once saying to me, but mum, I don't even know what you went through when you was a kid. Like, what am I grateful for? You know, and I was like, I had to stop in my tracks and go, of course he doesn't, because our lives are completely different. So we have to adopt a different mindset and a different mentality about money conversations with our children, especially if you have been through difficult circumstances, so that you don't pass that guilt on to your own children. Really, really, definitely. Really important for me.
Yeah, definitely. And you know what? I think it's almost a common theme running all the way through this episode, which is about that self-awareness at the, you know, the first line of defense, and thinking, particularly if you are responsible for raising children, what kinds of behaviors, habits, attitudes, etc., are they picking up from us, and which of those are positive and are going to lead them, you know, spur them on to success, and which are those that are going to stunt their development, stunt their growth? It's a really important thing to be thinking about, especially as parents. And when it comes to money, so much of what we learn about it comes from osmosis. You know, when no one's actively saying, this is how you manage your cash flow.
Yeah.
Or this is how you invest. Or these are the different types of investment instruments that are available. You know, no one's necessarily proactively having that conversation. So you just kind of pick it up and hope for the best.
That's exactly it. Yeah. And I think the fact that you've mentioned that nobody talks about it, no one talks about it. I was thinking about that going, no one talks about it. And I was trying to reflect on who talked about it to me. No one talked about it. So yeah, it's really important, really important conversation to have.
And so just reflecting on your upbringing then, and against that backdrop, what does financial freedom mean to you? And of course, again, financial freedom is one of these terms that's used quite commonly. It means different things to different people. For some people, it might mean being completely debt-free if you're someone that struggled with debt all, you know, over the course of your life. For others, it might mean never having to work. And again, lots of these things are rooted in, you know, gosh, if I've had an experience where I've been working my socks off, I've been doing 15-hour days, 16-hour days, financial freedom for me is I don't have to do that anymore. Yeah. What does it mean to you? And I guess, you know, have you made, would you say could you point towards, you know, a money move that you or you and your husband have made jointly on your financial journey that is moving you in that direction of financial freedom?
I have always been really careful with money. Don't spend it. Keep it. Make sure that you've got enough to pay your bills. Make sure you've got enough to pay all of these things. And having a disposable income for me has never been something that I thought I could ever have, you know. So it was always you work, you pay your bills, you get enough money to pay to eat, and that's it. And if you've got that, then you should be grateful for that. I remember speaking to my mum about this years ago, and for her, she started buying shoes. She loved shoes, and she qualified. I watched my mum graduate when she was 40 as a social worker, and it's been amazing. And that meant for her going out and buying whatever she wanted. For me, it was the same thing, but going out and buying things without asking permission, I think, is one of the things that means financial freedom for me. I went and bought Rihanna's Savage Fenty, her perfume. It is gorgeous, but it's about 150 quid. And I went and bought it. I just bought it. And afterwards, I had to sit with how that felt for me, you know. It's £150. Yeah. You know, to a lot of people, that is an awful lot of money. To me, absolutely, it's an awful lot of money. For others, that's a drop in the ocean. That's nothing, you know. But
yeah,
for me, I had to kind of reflect and go, actually, Danielle, I'm 44 years old. I'm now in a position where if I want to go and buy something for myself, I can go buy it. And I can feel good because I've earned the money that has gone into me buying that perfume. And it sits on my side and it smells good and I earn it. And it feels good for me. So financial freedom for me is about the little things. Mm. I think on a bigger scale, financial freedom would be obviously clearing down mortgages, our mortgage, and being free so that if we didn't want to work as hard as we are, then we've got a little bit of leeway. You know, that would be the ultimate financial freedom for us, I think.
I love that. I think that's the perfect way to conclude this episode. Danielle, thank you so much for your time today. Where can people find you, access support and help, and find out more about ABC Life Support, CIC, yeah, as well as Black Minds Matter UK?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am on Instagram because I know I have a love-hate relationship, but I am definitely on there.
Yes.
And that is at Danielle Bridge _ CEO. And in terms of LinkedIn, it's Danielle Bridge. And in terms of BMM UK, so we've got a website, which is www.blackmindsmatteruk.com. And ABC Love Support, again, abclovesupport.co.uk. And that's where you'll be able to find out all about the work that I do on a daily basis. But thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Amazing. Yeah, it's such a brilliant conversation. And I hope that all the listeners, there's at least one nugget that they can take away and start to apply straight away. So thank you so much for your expertise. Enjoy the rest of your day. Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck, and don't forget to share, like, rate, review and subscribe. See you next time.